The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black.
On this episode, we'll get some advice on what we need to do to survive in an increasingly dangerous world. Our guest is Judith Matloff, who's a veteran international correspondent who instructs others on how to survive hostile environments. Over a 40-year career as a journalist, she's covered stories around the globe, and her work has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, Christian Science Monitor, Forbes, and the Los Angeles Times, just to name a few.
And Judith has developed protocols for digital, gender, and physical security, and she also consults for leading organizations like the State Department and the United Nations. And she's the author of the new book, How to Drag a Body and Other Safety Tips You Hope to Never Need. Judith, thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
We have all been thinking about COVID-19, obviously, in recent months, and I know it's been at the forefront of your mind as well. It has upended our lives, and I'm wondering what observations you have to share about it and how we've responded to it.
Well, you know, it's such a good question because it is an extreme crisis. It's, for a lot of people, it's probably the worst crisis they've ever encountered. And the coping mechanisms to deal with it are very, very similar to the one that foreign correspondents deploy when they're covering crises like war. You need to take the long view. You need a fair amount of emotional resilience to get through this anxiety-producing experience where we don't really know that much about the disease, and also we don't know for how long our lives are going to be upended. And when you're covering a war as a journalist, it's the same sort of thing. You've just got to develop a lot of emotional stamina to power yourself through it.
It's so crazy to me that even though this is a really dangerous situation, it seemed like people were more panicked about buying toilet paper and running out of that and hand soap and paper towels than anything. Is that surprising to you?
No, it actually happens in all crises. The toilet paper was surprising to me because this is largely a respiratory illness. But in every crisis, people worry about toilet paper. It's a really bizarre thing, and I think it could make a fantastic thesis for a psychologist to examine why that is. But, you know, what the crisis really hit home, and this is the theme of the book, is that if you contemplate a dangerous situation and you prepare for it, you're going to be far more calm when it actually hits. So, for instance, we're in the throes of this thing right now. If you live in an area which could be prone to wildfires or hurricanes, start thinking now about how you would handle these crises during a pandemic. Don't wait until the fires begin or the Category 5 hurricane rolls in. You want to get yourself ready now. And, you know, the other thing about preparation is that it seems counterintuitive, but if you can allow yourself mentally to go to the worst case scenario, what could be the worst thing that could happen to me? And then you plan backwards to mitigate these adverse effects or just figure out how you would cope with it. You're actually going to be a lot calmer when it actually happens.
Going along with what you just touched on, the fact that we may be in a situation in some parts of the country where we have to deal with wildfires or hurricanes or earthquakes during this pandemic, and you suggested people be thinking ahead to that. What kinds of things should they be thinking about if they're faced with a double crisis?
Right. Well, first of all, when you live in an area that's prone to natural disasters, it's always good to have a little go-to bag ready just in case you have to evacuate. The worst thing is, you know, what happens to people if they don't have their key documents with them, or they don't have their clothing, their spare set of keys, all those kinds of things. If you don't have that ready and suddenly you've got to leave the house, it's going to be a lot more complicated for you in the weeks ahead. Now, layering on top of having all your documents with you, let's say spare cash, batteries, clothing for maybe 2 weeks, a medical kit. What you also need right now are supplies for COVID in case you do have to go to a public shelter. So that's one. The second thing is that these sort of places that would have been public shelters in the past may not be operating as such now because of the need for social distancing. So whereas, you know, I live in an area in New York City which is prone to hurricanes, and normally we would go to a school 3 blocks from my house. Well, that school is probably not going to be the place for us to evacuate now due to the new standards that we have on social distancing. So I would recommend that people find out where they would have to go now, because it could be very, very different. And I would also just, I would suggest that everybody who lives anywhere where there are natural disasters should have a what's called an NOAA radio. It's a hand-cranked emergency radio, which doesn't rely on batteries. It doesn't rely on electrical power sources. And through that radio, the authorities will always issue emergency alerts. And I really think it's just something everybody should have in the house, no matter where they live.
Why is it that we avoid talking about strategy techniques until it's too late, and then it's just a complete panic?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it heralds back to what I was saying before, which is that people don't want to think about the worst case scenario because they fear it's going to make them more anxious. But in fact, if you think about it and you make a plan, everything goes a lot smoother. But I think it's human nature to be in denial and to just not want to think about something that's really scary. But I'll give you an example on that shows why it actually helps to be prepared. Because my husband and I have worked in crisis zones for so many years, we have about a month's supply of cash, we have a month's supply of batteries, and we have about a month's supply of non-perishable food in the house. We also always have N95 masks, we always have gloves, we always have wipes. It's just part of what we always have in our basement. So when the pandemic hit New York, and New York became the world epicenter, we weren't actually in New York City at our home at the time. My husband was abroad, I was upstate at a writer's residency, and our son was in college in California. But when we all got back to New York, which really was when people had already done all their panic shopping and there was no more of a lot of these supplies in the stores, we didn't have to worry because we already had it in our basement. So we were pretty low key about the preparation element because we already were prepared.
Now, as far as the preparation is concerned, you wrote back in March, I think March 4th, you published an article talking about how, hey, everybody, get ready. This is coming. The quarantine is coming. You might need to be prepared for a month. I was looking at the article last night and you said you might need to be prepared for a month. Well, obviously, it's gone longer than that. And now we're hearing about the dreaded second wave that may happen. What can people do to sort of get away from this idea that, oh, okay, I'm kind of tired of COVID-19. I want to move on from this. And isn't that kind of a concern that people are going to let up their guard?
Yeah, it's definitely a concern. I think we're seeing it across the country. I mean, there's lockdown fatigue. People are so tired of being socially isolated. They're so tired of not going out. They're so tired of not being able to do the things that consist of normal life. But it's really, really, really important to keep abreast of the CDC guidelines, to keep abreast of what scientists are saying and health authorities, because we don't want to get sick. We don't want to make other people sick. And the sooner we all adhere to the restrictions that we're now living through, the sooner we're going to get through this. You know, I look at New York, for instance, where I think we had fantastic state leadership with Governor Cuomo. And, you know, it was like the apocalypse for a while in New York. It was really, really, really bad. But now we're one of the safest places in the country to live. And it just shows that if you can be disciplined and you can, if you adhere to common scientific sense, the crisis will pass quicker.
This episode is sponsored by Ritual. We want to tell you more about why we're big believers in all of Ritual's products, and we want to share a special offer for our listeners from Ritual.
You may have heard us talk about Ritual's essential protein products or Ritual's essential for women 18 plus multivitamin. And now we want to tell you about another great product from Ritual called Symbiotic Plus.
It's my daily 3-in-1 clinically studied prebiotic, probiotic, and postbiotic designed to help support a balanced gut microbiome. If your gut's telling you it needs a little support, Ritual has your back.
With Ritual's Symbiotic Plus, I get two of the world's most clinically studied probiotic strains to support the relief of mild and occasional digestive discomforts like bloating, gas, and diarrhea.
So why include a postbiotic? Well, it provides fuel to the cells that make up the gut lining, and it supports a healthy gut barrier.
Symbiotic Plus is a delayed release capsule that's designed to help survive the harsh conditions of the upper GI tract for delivery to the colon, an ideal place for probiotics to grow and thrive.
Symbiotic Plus comes in an all-in-one, single-nested, minty capsule. There's no refrigeration needed, so it's easy to take with you when you travel.
Symbiotic Plus and Ritual are here to celebrate, not hide your insides. It's time to listen to your gut. Ritual is offering our Nobody Told Me listeners 10% off during your first 3 months.
Visit ritual.com/NTM to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today.
All you have to do is visit ritual.com/NTM to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today.
These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration, and this product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Visit ritual.com/NTM to start Ritual or add Symbiotic Plus to your subscription today.
How do you suggest that we talk to younger kids about scary events like this without panicking them, but also conveying that these are potentially dangerous situations for them? They need to wash their hands, they need to socially distance, and they need to take it seriously.
Yeah, again, and such great questions. Be as matter of fact as possible. Children are like animals. They sense your anxiety, they sense your fear. And of course, we're all very, very on edge about this. But really, you know, take some deep breaths, really think about the words that you're going to use before you sit down with the kids and talk to them, and try to make anything that you can into a game. For instance, the hand washing, if you've got some silly song that you can have them sing, if there's any way to make what is restrictive fun. For instance, my son, my teenage son, is babysitting for some young children right now, now that our lockdown is pretty much over. And the kids really have not left the house for a very long period of time. So what they did is they built a house within the house, a fort. And so being confined to the house became a project. That could be one example. Another example I heard from someone in China was that she was actually quarantined with two small children in a hotel room in China. And so they built sculptures of everything in the closet. So just anything that you can do to make it seem fun, to make things a game. But without a doubt, you know, it's very hard for kids to cognitively wrap their minds around the fact that they can't see their friends.
How important is routine during a time like this when things seem so very unsettled and we just don't really have an end date?
Yeah, it's absolutely critical, because a routine makes things seem normal during even an abnormal time like this. The other thing which I would recommend is not only have a daily routine, but also maybe set a weekly routine, but don't project too much into the future. Because if you start worrying about, oh my goodness, you know, what are we going to do if we're still doing this in January? Or, you know, how much longer can I take this? It seems overwhelming. But if you have a daily routine that you hold to, you get up at the same time every day, you go to bed at the same time every day, you eat meals at regular times, you exercise at regular times, you get into a rhythm which does feel normal. And it also keeps you from projecting into the future, because your routine really is to get to the end of the day. So it's very, very grounding. But within that routine, pay really strong attention to your physical health. Try to get a lot of rest. eat really, really well and get exercise. Exercise is absolutely critical when you're dealing with a very stressful situation.
Like we mentioned at the beginning of the interview, your new book is called How to Drag a Body and Other Safety Tips You Hope to Never Need, which is such an interesting title. And we were wondering what inspired that and the book in general.
The title, I just want to make clear, it's not about dragging dead bodies.
Okay.
It's actually dragging bodies from an injured person. For instance, dragging somebody from a car accident site before the emergency responders can come. And with the training workshops that I do, it's a very, very big part of the training that we do. Because let's say there's a school shooting, let's say there's an active shooter, again, let's say somebody is in an earthquake zone and some rubble falls around them, you want to know how to extract that person in a safe way. It actually is a very, very useful tool. So that's where the title came from. And the genesis of the book is, what it was is that when I started doing foreign reporting 40 years ago, we did not have safety protocols. And so I would get myself into like the most ridiculously dangerous situations. Like, you know, nobody told me that you don't walk towards crossfire and gunfire to find out what's going on. Nobody told me that when you get a death threat, you should report it immediately instead of trying to shrug it off and be all macho about it and pretend that you're not worried. And so after, you know, a few years of doing this job, and this is before we wore flak jackets covering war, and this is before the Me Too movement, when people were talking about sexual harassment on the job. So what was happening is that quite a few friends were killed, they were maimed, they were tortured, they were raped, or their communications were hacked. And it occurred to me and a small group of other colleagues that we needed to do this in a safer, more systematic way. So when I returned to the United States 20 years ago and began teaching at Columbia University, I incorporated new safety protocols into my teachings so that the journalists of the new generation would not make some of the absolutely ridiculous mistakes I made. So then what happened is invariably one thing leads to another. So then my trainings began to, they began not just to be centered at Columbia University, but I began to go to Africa, the Middle East, particularly Mexico, to train journalists who were in danger in other parts of the world. And then what would happen is, you know, I'd come back to New York and ordinary people who knew what I was doing for a living would ask me questions. You know, my sister's a social worker and she's married to a Puerto Rican and they were going to Puerto Rico and they were worried about Zika or they were worried about Category 5 hurricanes. So how do they prepare? Or a friend whose daughter would be spending a year abroad in Jordan and Israel wanted to know what sort of safety precautions her daughter should take. So I was getting all these sort of queries. And then it just occurred to me, why don't I just put it in a book?
Yeah.
And then, you know, even people that I don't know can get these answers. So that's how it happened.
So going with the title of the book, How to Drag a Body and Other Safety Tips You Hope to Never Need, how do you drag a body if you need to pull someone out of a dangerous situation?
Well, what you want to do is secure the head and the neck so that it doesn't flop around and you could cause damage to the spine. If the person is vomiting, put the person on his or her side because you don't want them to choke on the vomit. And one of the best ways to cradle the head is to secure them under the armpits so that the head is cradled against your chest, or maybe you will pull them on a tarp or with a towel. But again, you want to keep the head and the neck very, very stable.
If there's only one thing that we learn health-wise in terms of how to help somebody, what is that one thing? Is it CPR or what should we do?
I think probably the most useful thing, I mean, definitely CPR has sort of gone out of fashion with emergency responders and first aid classes. I think the most important thing is knowing what to do if somebody stops breathing and know how to staunch bleeding. That's absolutely critical. And I'll give you two examples. When the Boston Marathon bombing happened and when there was that massacre in Las Vegas, passerbys, bystanders, were able to save lives because they knew how to tie tourniquets and they knew how to apply pressure on bleeding wounds. Because oftentimes somebody can bleed out in a few minutes, and it takes a few minutes for the emergency responders to arrive. So all these lives were saved because bystanders knew emergency first aid. So I think it's absolutely critical.
What kind of advice can you tell us?
Well, in our safety courses, again, you know, we teach people how to drag bodies. We teach people how to identify whether somebody is breathing or not. We teach them how to staunch bleeding, again, applying pressure, be it with a tourniquet or, you know, with your hands. We even teach people how to stop bleeding with the femoral artery, which is very, very tricky. What we do is we get chickens and we fill them with all this red goop that we pump inside, and they have to learn how to, they have to desensitize themselves so they can stick their hand inside a putative victim and stop the bleeding. And, you know, another thing, you know, we teach people about burns. There are a lot of misconceptions about burns. We teach them what to do if your finger gets caught. Don't put it on ice. It's not an oyster. What you do is you put it in a Ziploc bag and you keep it cool and well sealed, but you don't want to put it on ice because that will destroy the tissue. And the other thing that we teach in my classes, which unfortunately is really, really important in America right now, is what to do if somebody's overdosing on opioids. And I always carry with me something that I can get at my Rite Aid, and I believe you can get it over the counter in 40 states. It's a very, very simple nose spray, and you spray it up somebody's nose if they're ODing, and it doesn't have side effects, and it will save their lives. So I always walk around with gloves, just in case I, you know, find somebody and I have to stick my hand up, you know, hand somewhere to save them. And I always carry around this little bottle.
What's that called?
Narcan. There are other names. So what you would do is you would simply go to your pharmacist and say, usually there's a sign right there at the pharmacy, we dispense such and such. There are different names, different brands. But if you simply explain that you want the nose spray for people who are overdosing on opioids. And the other thing we teach people is how to identify whether somebody's just passed out drunk or whether they're actually ODing. And the key is to rub your knuckles into their chest, because if they're just passed out from alcohol, they'll start responding. So you know that, therefore, you probably don't have to stick this thing up somebody's nose.
Interesting. Wow. I had no idea.
Yeah, you know, take a workshop.
you know, a lot of people also have been taking part in recent protests related to the Black Lives Matter movement. And I'm wondering what advice you have for someone who wants to express their feelings in a protest of any kind, but doesn't want to get hurt in a crowd.
Yeah, the critical thing, and it's all the more important as we try to social distance, because you have two dangers here. You have the danger of being hurt in the protests, and you also have the danger of contracting something from somebody who shouts next to you. So what we tell people is to stay on the edge of the crowd. You don't need to get into the middle, and if you get into the middle, you might get trapped. So that if you see the police approaching with tear gas or batons, you can run away really quickly because you're on the edge. And if you're on the edge, it's more easy to socially distance. And when you go to a protest, always figure out, if you can beforehand, what the modus operandi is of the group and find out how the police have responded to them in the past. Because that might give you an indication as to what direction the protest might go. The other thing I would recommend that everybody do is find out how your local law enforcement responds to responds with crowd control tactics. It varies from city to city. For instance, they love to use sound cannons in Pennsylvania. So if you're going to a protest in Pennsylvania, you probably want to get really, really good ear protectors. For tear gas, which everybody seems to be using these days, you want to have a bottle of water to rinse out your eyes. You want to have goggles. You want to cover as much of your skin as possible with disposable clothing. So if it gets contaminated, you want to throw it away. And you want to, most importantly, you want to carry as many spare masks as you can. You can hand them out to the people next to you, And if there's tear gas or pepper spray, you don't want to use that mask again. So you want to have some spares on your person.
You mentioned just a minute ago about how it's important for us to learn how to get somebody breathing if they are not breathing. What do we do if it's not CPR?
Well, that really is the only thing you can do.
Okay, so you need to learn how to do CPR.
Yeah, I mean, the thing about these Red Cross courses, or there's another course that's offered for free throughout the country, it's called Stop the Bleed. These courses don't take a lot of time. You could take a 4 to 6 hour course.
So that's pretty simple and could save a life.
It could, yeah. The thing to keep in mind is that you need refreshers, because muscle memory is necessary to go through the motions so that they're automatic. The motions of saving somebody's life should be as automatic as riding a bicycle or doing the breaststroke when you're swimming. And the thing is, you lose that muscle memory if you don't practice it. So we recommend with the people who take our courses that they get reaccredited every 6 to 12 months. 6 months is probably a little bit excessive, but definitely after a year, you want to take a refresher course just to make sure that you remember how to do everything.
What's your best advice if we should find ourselves in an active shooter situation?
Yeah, you want to run. You want to get away as quickly as you can. If that's not an option, obviously you need to hide. And again, this is where preparation comes in. We always teach the people that take our workshops, anytime they go into a mall, anytime they go into a public space, even a movie theater, think about where the exits are. Always be aware of how you can get out of a situation. And this doesn't turn you into a paranoid maniac. It actually becomes like riding a bicycle, becomes road after a while. You go into a new place and you suss out how you would get out of it. You would also suss out where you might hide behind. You know, is there a dumpster outside the building? You know, is there a column that you can hide behind? It's just as it becomes habit after a while. Just every time you go into a situation, try to suss out where you would hide and how you would get out of there.
You touched on this before, but our show is called Nobody Told Me, and we always ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? You just gave a couple of great ones a few minutes back. But what is it that nobody told you about preparation that you wish that they had when you started your career that would have helped you overcome some difficult times?
Nobody told me what to do when there was shooting. And I think that probably, you know, in terms of life-threatening situations, that was probably the most life-threatening, being in situations where people were shooting in my direction or they were pointing guns at me. But just generally, nobody told me that I should have a plan before I go into a situation. And, you know, that's a more meta. Nobody told me. And it's since become my life philosophy and it's what I teach, but nobody told me that you shouldn't just stumble into a situation, particularly a dangerous situation, without thinking about how you would extract yourself and how you would deal with it.
What have you learned about yourself during those times when you've been in dangerous or dirty situations?
Well, I'm like what I guess people would call sort of a type A, high-strung kind of person. But what I learned about myself is that under pressure, I actually was fairly calm. And I had a lot more emotional resilience than I thought I would. That I was able to be fairly clear-headed. And what I also have found is, again, it's, you know, my mantra. If I have a plan or if I've thought through the what if, I'm really, really a lot calmer because I've thought it through and I have a plan and I can take action. So that is really, I guess, what I've learned about myself. And, you know, I think we all really need to pat ourselves on the back and be nice to ourselves with this pandemic, because I think a lot of people have learned a lot of lessons about how they've really been able to cope with this. This is a very, very difficult situation. And despite the enormous emotional stress that we're all under, I think most people have coped a lot better than they thought they would. And they need to give themselves credit for that.
And I think it's helped as well that we've had such a great community of people who are all going through the same thing at mm-hmm. the same time. So we've been able to help each other. And in a lot of ways, this has been something that's united us and maybe we needed as a society.
Yeah. And you've hit upon something really important, which is psychologists that deal with trauma, that deal with disasters, that deal with crises and emergencies say the one thing which determines emotional resilience is a sense of community and a sense of social support. And I think, you know, the human spirit is you know, gravitates towards survival and resilience. And I think the fact that people started to connect on Zoom and have these 5 o'clock Zoom cocktails is a testimony to the human spirit to just get through something. You know, people realized instinctively that they needed to connect. And I think, you know, it's not, you know, we'd like to give the hugs and we'd like to see people in person and it's really difficult. But the Zoom connection and the other ways that people are connecting has been really important in sustaining people throughout this.
And Judith, how can people connect with you on social media and the internet?
Okay, I'm on Twitter and I have a website, www.judithmatloff.com. I'm on Facebook and I'm on LinkedIn. And please, if you have any queries, please contact me.
This has been such a fascinating interview, and I think you've given our audience so much information that we can use every day, not just during the quarantine, but for long after. So we really appreciate that. And we really appreciate you writing this book that is so needed.
Well, thank you. It's been an absolute delight to talk with you. And stay safe, everybody. And this isn't permanent. It is going to end at some point. So don't lose hope. You know, this isn't the rest of our lives.
Excellent words of advice. Thank you so much, Judith.
Thank you. Thank you.
Again, our thanks to Judith Matloff. Her latest book is called How to Drag a Body and Other Safety Tips You Hope to Never Need. And again, her website is judithmatloff.com.
I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. Thank you so much for joining us.